If you want to build a portfolio of more than just three properties, you absolutely must understand the game of finance and how to break the barriers to build a great passive income through a portfolio of properties. Hi, I'm Jared Krause. I'm the co-host of the Property Powers Australia podcast. And in this episode, Sam Powell and myself, the co-host, and I chat to Stephen McClatchy, who is the founder and director of Loans Australia since 2002. Now, Steve has been in the finance industry for over 27 years and has overseen over more than $1 billion of mortgage settlements, which is insane to think about. And he's also earned a place in the top 100 best mortgage brokers in Australia over the last 4 years. So Stephen, as you can see, as we get into this episode, is just a wealth of knowledge. He just fire hoses us with so many great things we should be thinking about. We discuss the common pitfalls that hold people back on getting finance for property number two and three and beyond to get to those five properties, 10 properties. We also talk about the alternatives and the strategies that can allow people to get more than two to three properties, from maybe buying in different structures to choosing the right lender and the right assets to buy. We also discuss having more than one property in a trust or an entity, and when you should be doing this, when you shouldn't be doing this. We talk about cross-collateralization within one entity, when if you should be doing this, when you should not be doing this, and maybe why you shouldn't be doing that. We also talk about what stage people should be looking at building large portfolios, what stage they should be moving from residential to commercial to scale the growth in their property portfolio. We also discuss buying property. When people are buying property, being heavily invested in the interest rate and how that can hold them back. We talk about what's more important than the interest rate itself when you're investing in a property portfolio. We also talk about rent vesting versus owning a home and the incredible facts and figures around the difference between those two different investment strategies. We don't dive into that as much because we're probably going to do another podcast episode with Stephen because he is such a wealth of knowledge, but this is super valuable. Now, before we get stuck into the podcast episode, I want to let you know this is not the only way that we can help you for free. We do have our how to maximize. Obviously, you want to maximize your borrowing capacity. We've got that as a mini course that you can go away and get at propertypals.au/resources that can help you get a better, superior asset through getting a higher borrowing capacity. Now let's dive into the pod. Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, gents. Very happy to be here.
Yes, Sam knows. Sam's helped me buy some property before and knows that I've worked with you guys at Loans Australia too on my first two residential properties. And it's been hugely beneficial. So thank you so much for that already.
Oh, more than welcome. Happy to help.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to get you on. I've heard you speak on other pods before. And yeah, you're just a wealth of knowledge. So I'm on a property journey, and so is Sam. Sam's got a few properties, and we are just wanting to grow our portfolios and be students. I'm more so the student. Sam's the guru valuer. So I'm the one that probably learns the most out of this pod. But we wanted to dive into like how people move beyond just one or two properties in their portfolio and getting stuck in financing. Are there some common pitfalls that people make when they purchase their first few properties that hold them back without having the foresight to go beyond three properties and so on?
Well, that's an excellent question, Jared. That really is, because I actually face that every day with clients, because pretty much everyone we deal with is investors. And there's a range of things that can hold people back. And some of it's got to do with how they earn their income. Because at the end of the day, if you're a PAYG salary earner, you're a bit limited in how much you can earn and how fast your income is going to grow over the years. And as we know, especially the last couple of years, we've had so many interest rate rises, that's really affected people's ability to borrow. And if they are, if everything's in their own personal names in their PAYG borrowers, that's where people have had, you know, a few problems moving forward. And so probably the number one thing that people need to get right from the beginning is what their end goal is, because what they're ending up to do is how we set them up from day one. So if they're only wanting to buy a couple of properties, it's going to be very different, the structure, as if they want to buy 10 plus. Because most people, if you're buying 10 properties and they're, say, $500,000 each, it's $5 million, most people don't have the income you would think to service, you know, $4 million plus worth of debt. And so then, okay, if they're wanting to do that, then we've got to really think about how you're going to have the income requirements to meet the bank's criteria over the next 5 or 10 years of you building a portfolio. And realistically, if they're not going to be able to achieve that, probably PAYG, then maybe we've got to look at other ways that they've got to set themselves up from day one to be able to show more income. And that could be using structures. And so we talk a lot about with our clients about what structure you can own the property in, because that will determine how much money they can borrow over a long period of time. Look, as I talk, just if I go off on a tangent, just slow me down or ask me a different question. But when you're buying property, there's many ways to hold the property, because you could hold it in your own name. You could hold it in a name with a partner. That partner could be your life partner or a business partner or a friend. You can own the property in a company structure. You can own it in a trust with an individual as a trustee. I won't go into the technicals at the moment, or a company as a trustee. You could own it in a superannuation environment. You could own a property in a joint venture with a range of people. And you can own the property, and when we're talking about trust, in a range of different styles of trust as well, which all these entities affect your ability to borrow. And they're all different ways of serviceability, of how banks calculate how much you can borrow, depending on the structure you want to set up. And people don't really understand that. And what I've found over 28 years of doing this is that not a lot of accountants walk through the different methods and what it means from a finance perspective. Yes, obviously they're very good at tax, and the better ones will talk about land tax and capital gains and other issues like that. But most of them won't talk about, okay, if you go in your own name, how that's going to affect your borrowing capacity compared to putting it, say, in a company and trust structure. So this maybe sounds like a little bit high level, but it is the conversations that people need to have up front, which will help them sustain their portfolio instead of being capped out, which most people are at one or two, maybe if they're lucky, three properties. That's probably the starting point, is understanding where the portfolio wants to go, then working out what sort of structures you need to put in place to help you achieve that portfolio at the end of the day.
Yeah, I love that. And so with the, you said the end, these different structures, they determine, you know, whether you can get borrowing capacity or not and financing or not. How do these structures affect your borrowing capacity?
Great question.
One way or the other.
And it's a very interesting question to do that. And to maximize the effect of the borrowing capacity, we like people over time, if they're not self-employed, we like people to set up what they call now a side hustle or a business.
Okay.
Because if they do that, that's going to give us more flexibility in how they can earn their income, how they can move, and we'll get into this probably later on, how they can move their expenses around, because that's also a massive barrier, which we'll talk about, of how banks calculate their borrowing capacity. But with the structures, it's very interesting because legally, when you're buying in your own name, it's actually a different legal structure to whether you buy in, say, a company and trust. They actually operate differently. And it's a little bit difficult. If you've never been a self-employed, it's difficult to understand how that all works. But these are things that you really need to take the time to understand when you're first starting out, because, you know, it's actually quite easy to build a portfolio of around 10 properties. But most people never get there because they don't take it to the next level and understand this sort of structuring thing. Because the good thing is that if you start to buy in companies and trusts, there's other parts of the bank which are open to you to lending. So most people, majority of people get their loans through what we call the residential part of the bank. So they might walk in off the street into a CBA branch. They could use a mortgage broker who uses, a range of 20 lenders, and that's all using the residential part of the bank. But there are actually other parts of the bank that want to give you a loan if you qualify. There's places like called business banking. There's commercial banking, there's specialized markets, there's private banking, there's even agribusiness banking. There's lots of different parts of the bank which have different ways of calculating their ability to give you money. And so as you're building your portfolio, most people, in our case, we want to tap into different parts of the bank because we're going to get a different outcome. But we have to have other structures in place to do that. So you can't go to business bank and buy a residential investment property in your own name. That's not what they do. That's not their area. Then you go to residential. But as soon as you start using structures, then it opens up the whole banking network too, especially gives us more options.
Sounds to me. With your history, right? Like a lot of people do start out in that, they are PAYG and they go in their personal names. Is it that they hit that barrier and then they come to you and say, Stephen, look, I'm struggling. I want to go again, but I can't. It's a pretty common sort of question.
Yep.
Is it a, more often than not, is it kind of like a sell down strategy to then restructure it from a perfect starting point again in your eyes? Or are you trying to, blend that personal name and then building that next level of the portfolio growth? Or is it a case by case basis?
It has to be case by case. I start off in the insurance and then financial planning industry, but I sold that business 20 years ago. So I can't give financial advice anymore. So we certainly stick in our lane. We've got our own credit license with ASIC. So that means that we can give advice in the financing part. Mm. When it comes to things like legal structures and accounting, yes, we're very au fait with it because we've been doing it for 30 years, but we can't give advice. So we give ideas about what our clients are doing, what our successful clients have done, what we've heard, and then we ask them to either speak to their own accountant or we can put them in touch with someone who understands the property flavor of it. So we don't give individual advice. In your question, it is extremely common because, yes, we do have a lot of PAYG clients. And some will say, okay, and again, we don't give individual property advice. We do use one particular person who they've got a chartered accountancy background, but they're very big in property. They've done lots of things property-wise, and they provide some property advice to clients as to what they think they can do with these properties. And there's other people out there who do that sort of thing as well, independent of a buyer or something like that. And so some clients may decide, look, I've bought this property in a outskirts suburb somewhere. It's probably got not much potential to grow. It's costing me $10,000 a year to keep the upkeep. And they might decide, look, this is not the right property for them. It started out as being the right property, but they didn't understand property. Because a lot of people buy property with not really an idea of what they're buying. And it's only when they go to people like yourselves who are experts in that area where they get a bit better knowledge around what they need to do. Is there upside potential? Can I add value to the property? Because at the end of the day, finance is really easy. It's all about income and expenses. And at the end of the day, you've got growth, you've got assets and liabilities. So you've got to look at each individual asset you've got. Can I improve that asset? Can I make more income off the asset? Can I reduce the expenses? And you might determine, looking at this asset, it's a dog with fleas. It's never going to go anywhere. It's not going to give me anything. I'm not going to get much rental growth. Capital growth's going nowhere, so I can't release any equity. It's not really helping my portfolio structure. So in that case, if it was me, I would probably get rid of it. I'd bite the bullet. And a lot of it's, I find, psychological. A lot of people don't like selling things. They don't like going backwards. And that's because they don't really have a plan. If they had a plan, they knew where they were going. They knew they had to take this one step sideways or backwards to get that better asset, because that better asset's going to give them more capital growth potential, more income potential, and it's going to help them achieve their goal quicker. So I'd say for a lot of clients I've seen, a very good step is to sell. Just admit, okay, maybe this is not the right asset I've been buying. Maybe we've seen lots of people buy right in their backyard. So they live in one suburb and they start buying around their suburb because they think they're going to drive past it. The amount of properties I've bought I've never even seen is the majority of them. I don't even care where it is. I just care, is it going to perform? I don't want to see it. I don't want to spend my time going to some of the suburbs where I've bought. I just want it to perform. And I want a good manager to make sure it's going to do what I want it to do.
I heard if you drive past it more, it goes up in value, though. Have you heard that?
Maybe if you cut the lawn and put a cubby, granny flat on the back of one of your drive-bys, you'd be right.
Yeah, that's
say,
great.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's good for your ego to buy in your backyard and make you feel good. But if it's purely you buying based on a numbers game, like you are, Stephen, I've got a property that's an hour and a half away from me. And I was like, my family's like, are you going to go have a look, you know, look at it? I was like, no, I don't care. Like, it's going to make money. And it's a numbers game for us as well. And being a numbers game, I wanted to circle the question back to, say, somebody that's starting out from scratch, and they come to you, Steve, and be like, all right, I've got 10 properties that I want to purchase. I want to build a portfolio of properties over a number of years. And I know this is going to be a very hard question to answer because it's going to be person dependent and their finances dependent. But as a very general rule of thumb and a very like general explanation, and we're not going to hold you to this because everybody's financial position is different. Cool. You know, we're not sharing, you know, legal or financial advice on this pod. Yeah. But for say somebody that has like a $80,000 to $100,000 wage, and they want to start investing in property, what's the typical structure on how they would start acquiring their first, second, third, fourth, and fifth? For example, yeah, I went and bought my first property in a trust, and it was profitable from the get-go. And then the second property I bought, I saw that it wasn't going to be profitable from the get-go, so I decided to buy it in my personal name, and it allowed me to have, cut that as a loss with my personal income and some tax savings and stuff like that. And then the next one is in a trust because it's going to be a commercial deal. I guess it depends on the type of property you buy, but say you said that, you know, they're buying 10 500K residential properties, $80,000 to $100,000 wage. How would they structure it in terms of buying in personal names, trusts, companies, whatnot, to get to five, I guess, from zero?
Yeah. Look, realistically, if they're on 80,000 to 100,000, they're not going to be able to buy 10 properties at $500,000 each. It's not, they're going to have to get smarter with what they buy to do that, because the average, and look, it depends also where they buy. This is where they need people like yourselves, because if they're PAYG, they've got some restrictions in place to grow a big portfolio. And so they have to be really smart with every step. They've got to be smart with how they set their finance up. They can be super smart with what they buy and where they buy, and whether it's going to be resi or commercial. Because whether it's residential at the moment, we can leverage a lot higher. For the average person, we can, you know, leverage to 95% with residential. And we can leverage, depending on the sort of person and what they're buying, anywhere between 80 to 100% for commercial. And so leverage is there depending on what they're buying and where. And if they've got a price point at the moment, you say under $500,000, they're going to be restricted also where they can buy. And so location is important. And Sam, as a valuer, know all about this, that the valuers have different perspectives about where they're buying in Australia, and some locations aren't what we call a metropolitan sort of top location for banks. And so as you're going more regional or smaller location, the banks can bring in restrictions. And it's not just the banking restrictions that come into it, it's also the valuation restrictions. Because let's say that someone's buying in Upper Whoop Whoop in Queensland, and there's, you know, 4,000 people there. The yield on the property or the rent might be 12%, which is phenomenal. Everyone wants 12% in their portfolio. But there might only be one valuer who services that area who goes there on a Tuesday each month. And so there's less options we've got to really maximize the value of that property, because you've only got one valuer who's going to go there. And so that is going to partly restrict the ability to grow, because if that valuer is having an off day or they don't believe in what you've done to the property, all of a sudden your $400,000 property is now 420, instead of potentially being in another area where we've got four or five valuers that we can play off against each other. And instead of one guy maybe going at 420, another guy's having a great day, or maybe he doesn't put the effort in and he's at 500. So Sam would know this, and this is what we do all the time, is we get at least five valuations on every property we value for a client, because the difference in valuations is huge. So that's just one thing we need to take into account. But as a PAYG person, what you started to do, Jared, is ideal, is that you've obviously been exposed to structures from day one. And so just because someone's PAYG doesn't mean they can't buy in a company in trust. And it does partly come down to cash flow, in my opinion, is that a good thing about buying in a structure is that not taking your situation into account, but if someone did have a positively or neutrally geared property, putting it in your own name, there's not going to be any tax benefits. Especially at the moment, if the interest rates are basically at the top of the peak of the market now, and you're not really negatively geared, you're probably never going to be in the next 10 to 20 years potentially, because hopefully the rates are going to start to come down over the next couple of years, and we'll see what happens after that. So if you're not really negatively geared now, you probably won't be in the next cycle anyway, over the next 7 or 8 years. So that way, if you're not really negatively geared, there's not a huge reason to have it in your own name, because by putting assets in a company and trust, there's a level of what we call asset protection in doing that as well. Because if you ever got sued, well, because the property's owned in a company and trust, it's not you, it's a separate legal entity, so they can't get at it, which is pretty cool. It doesn't protect you if you get divorced. I always get that. Oh, can I put it over here so then my partner can't get hold of it? No, no. Everything's shared. They say all of that, but it's more from an asset protection. It's beneficial. So what I would say is, yes, we want to look at the cash flow of the property. If it's not going to be any negative gearing at all, well, let's look at a company and trust, how that could benefit you. And with the second property, you said your one was potentially, there was a bit of negative gearing. What I'd be doing is looking at, okay, how much negative gearing is there? Is it a meaningful amount? If it's not, I probably would have put that in the first trust, because the positive cash flow from the first one would have offset the negative cash flow potentially from the second one. That way, the trust is still trading positively. And what that means from a serviceability aspect is that I have lenders where we can isolate that structure on its side over here, and we don't need to take into account for gearing for the next one. So when we look at growing people's portfolio, we can grow portfolios in your own name. We can grow portfolios in your and your partner's name, or just your partner's name. We can grow portfolios in one company and trust. But then, as I'll mention in a minute, we can set up a second company and trust as well, which grows separately, which I'll talk about. And then you can also grow it in your superannuation environment potentially as well. So we can have all these streams going at one time. So people think, oh, I want to grow 5 properties over 10 years. You could probably get 5 properties in 4 years. Because as we all know in property, the benefit of property is the capital growth over time. And to get capital growth and the whole compounding interest of it, well, compound interest is the backbone, but compound interest is based on time. So the quicker we can get our assets and then let them grow over a long period of time, the much more money we're going to get. And the people sort of don't always twig. They want to be, they think they're being conservative. I'll get one this year, then in 3 years, I'll get another one, and they add it all out. But really, the best way to make money is to get as many as you can, as quickly as you can, and then be able to hold them and just sit back and reap the rewards over a long period of time. And then you make a fortune. But a lot of people sort of don't have that mindset.
I love that. I love that mindset. I love that explanation on, you know, buying in trusts, buying as soon as you can to grow your portfolio as fast as you can. Because, yeah, you could buy maybe 5 in 4 years and then do nothing. Or after that, you know, the 5 that you bought in the 4 years, you know, you could grow your portfolio a lot faster than what you could if you were being conservative as well. So you can either choose to chill or you can choose to grow as well. And you mentioned, I love the explanation of, I could have bought that second property that I bought in my personal name in the trust, and then I could have not declared that as, you know, me owning that entity to the bank for borrowing capacity to buy another property. So it might have helped me get another one if I, you know, my serviceability wasn't as good as it might be.
Could I just expand on that? Because we do that a lot. And even accountants don't understand that structure sometimes, and we need to explain it to them, is that they're separate legal entities. So when you've set up that trust, think of it as a business. That trust is a business, and it's operating as a business. It just happens to be, at the moment, a property business. It just doesn't have to be a property business. So it can have other sorts of income coming in. So let's say that property business is trading at a loss of $1,000 or $2,000 a year once you've worked out the pros and cons. That business then could do something, some sort of consultancy or some sort of business, to generate a couple of $1,000s worth of income a year to make sure that it was neutrally geared, that always it wasn't a negative, it wasn't a loss, it was maybe a $10 profit. That's all you sort of need. As long as that business is trading profitably, that means it's paying its own debts when they fall due. We can look to isolate that with some banks. And that basically, exactly what you said, the bank will say, okay, that's taken care of itself. We don't need to worry about that entity. Let's look at what else Jared has. Oh, Jared's got no other debt. Okay, we can use all his income then to service more debt. And that's sort of how, very simplistic version of what they do. So in your case, what we might have said, okay, why don't we set up another trust over here and start the whole process over again? And then you might go out and say, oh, okay, Sam, go and find me a property which is neutrally geared or positively geared or not far off. And then you can keep building your portfolio by matching up the styles of properties. So in each trust, you might have a negatively geared property in there, but then you're going to go and try and pair it with one which is giving you positive cash flow. And if it doesn't, maybe that trust has to earn some other income to get it so it's servicing itself, so that business is making a profit, or, you know, at least neutrally geared and not, you know, running at a massive loss.
Can you give me a couple of examples of, I guess, putting that extra income into that trust to sort of for serviceability?
Yeah, well, it could be anything. So we have clients who drive Ubers. We have clients who have an online store and sell things. We have clients who have another business, and then this business provides consultancy services. So it could be a whole range of things to derive a little bit of income to make it that business is now making a profit. So what our goal is to have every one of these, you can call it a silo if you want, but I like to call it a business. So I like to have people in the frame that they're not buying property, they're building a business. They're building their property empire. That's what I like to think. I don't want the, it's just an investment. Oh, it is. Okay. It's just an investment. You'll end up with one or two. But if you think of it as a business, then you're going to end up with a profitable business. And then really the number of properties don't matter because you're just building your business and you're just then thinking, okay, how do I make my business profitable? Okay. Well, if the cash flow at the moment is 5,000 negatively cash flow, how am I going to make an extra 5,000 to make sure that that entity is trading profitably each year? Because when you think about it, what bank wants to lend to a loss-making vehicle? Just on a basic level, well, no one wants to lend to a loss-making vehicle. Okay, how do we turn it positive? It's very easy to turn something positive if you make a little bit of income somewhere. And it's not that hard to make $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year in income.
Is that kind of why earlier you mentioned it's good to have a company structure set up? Because then you can, I guess, you could even invoice your other trusts and distribute funds a lot easier that way.
I can't give accounting advice, but Sam, you've got a good mind there.
just general advice only, but no, that makes complete sense. And it's something that people obviously don't understand. And to be fair, how are you meant to understand? We don't teach this in school, and you've been doing this for 30 years. So it's just trying to find people like yourselves to educate.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a big problem because there's a lot of education around property, which is awesome because people love investments and they want to grow their wealth. But there's no point having a love of property if you don't understand finance and have some sort of a love of finance. I jokingly, when I do seminars, I talk about, you know, who loves finance. And over the years, it went basically no one putting their hand up to now maybe 30% of people putting their hand up because more people are understanding it's all about the finance. It's not about the property. You've got to understand the finance before you can understand the property. Because everyone likes they can see property, but no one sees finance. They don't understand. And even mortgage brokers have been in the business for 20 years. If they don't specialize in investment and understand it, unfortunately, they're giving, even though they're well-meaning, they're just giving the wrong advice. And I see it all the time. And there's not that many specialist investment brokers out there who are doing it.
If you look at buying property through like a systems perspective, like what you need to do is you need to buy the property. What's the biggest thing that gets in the way typically is finance. And if you understand that, then it doesn't need to get in the way. When you're ready to buy again, you go away and buy because you have those correct structures put in place that can allow you to get borrowing capacity to go again. And so I was going to ask you around like how many properties in one structure is too many. And I guess that, I'm not sure of the answer, but I'm just guessing that, you know, there's probably not a certain amount as long as it's profitable and as long as, you know, the land tax isn't getting too excessive, I guess, and a few of those.
A horrible word.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a horrible word, land tax. I hate it. I'd hate tax. Yeah. When everyone says tax to me, I think my head's going to explode. I hate it. But anyway. That's what I love about Kerry Packer. He's the only guy, you know, billionaire saying he doesn't pay any tax. Sure. I've always aspired to do that. I haven't achieved it yet. I'm still paying tax, but that's my aspiration.
Absolutely. So next, this is something that I'll
answer that question if you like about the number of properties in the trust, because that does come up a lot too. So we've got a client. I'll give you an example. I'm obviously not going to say who the client is, but we've got a client right at the moment who's got a trust and they've got 4 investment properties in this trust. And they got some advice and they were pretty smart and they got into trust fairly early and had a few properties outside of trust and bought 4 in the trust and kept buying because they didn't realize how borrowing capacity would affect them. And they bought another one in the trust without speaking to me before they did it. And they didn't realize then because they put that extra one in the trust, now their serviceability wasn't there. because if you're buying in the trust, that's a business. So that business has to show, if you're buying in the trust, that business has to show the serviceability. And they didn't have to do that. So we had to change the structure of that last property, had to change the contract of sale to make sure it's going to meet the guidelines to get what they needed. So we caught that early, luckily.
Very lucky.
But what I'd say is the number is determined on a couple of factors. One is the serviceability. That is, if you kept buying the same trust, that trust has to have the serviceability. So we need to look at that. And so also, income. Sorry. Hmm. And then also the business nature. So like you said, is it profitable? So it depends on the style of property you're putting in that trust. So we have some people who mix commercial and residential in a trust, and that's okay, because generally commercial sometimes might have stronger cash flow than maybe a residential. And so people might mix it up. They might have an office in there with a couple of resis, whatever it is. That's fine. So it's not really for me the number. It's more so the style of property and the income of that trust, which determines how many can sit in there. And look, you can look at liability, because commercial might have a different liability profile than a residential as well. So you need to take that into account. Especially we've got clients who buy a lot of shopping strips, and that has a different liability profile than someone buying just a standard resi house. So you're doing like medical centers and things like that, that, you know, once you get up the tree a bit and you've got the money, these sort of things are quite lucrative, especially in terms of cash flow. So it really depends on what you're buying, but initially I'd say only two or three for most people is probably plenty in a trust, and then start to get more entities as you go along just to maximize how much you can borrow.
Are you cross-collateralizing in that structure, that one trust structure, to keep that borrowing capacity and serviceability? Is that how the banks look at them?
That's a good question. I'll say yes and no, because what will happen in that trust is that, for us anyway, we keep every loan separate. So they're not what you're calling cross-collateralized from a structure standpoint on that particular property. So if you've got three properties in a trust, each property won't be securing on the loan the other one. So they're all sitting independently for most people, but it's a business. And so that entity owns these three properties. So say something goes wrong with one of the properties, because it's owned by an entity, the whole entity is on the line. And that's why asset protection is something you need to have a think about. Because if, let's say, I don't know, you had a massive flood and you're in a unit and they deem it was your fault, you left the bathtub on, or you caused the drama, and then all of a sudden the insurance is saying, oh no, it was your fault, you were negligent, we're not going to pay you. Now all of a sudden you've got three properties in that trust, you've got no insurance to cover you, and you're up for a $2 million claim. Oh no. That means that lawyer from the other side is going to love to sue you, because they've seen your entity and that entity's got three assets in it. So they're going to go hard, because they know they can claim against you because you've got all these assets in this entity. And so even though they might not have been cross-collateralized, all of a sudden the whole portfolio is on the line because they're owned by the one entity. And same with the bank, is that the bank might only have security over one of those properties individually, but if something goes wrong, because that entity is all exposed, there's no reason at all they couldn't start to go. If they don't get their money back from selling one property, then they can go to the next one in the entity, because they're all guaranteeing the same thing.
Yeah, that goes from a risk perspective too, to not go, like when you say two or three, sounds like a more healthy than putting like four, five, six, because then you're more exposed.
Yeah, look, you don't, people get hung up about interest rates and fees. But they're in the whole scheme of building a portfolio, yes, they're important, but they're not the most important thing. If it's going to cost you $1,000 to set up another entity structure, that's minor compared to the asset protection benefits, the borrowing capacity benefits that you're going to have. If you can get one more property for $500,000, which doubles in 8 to 10 years, and now you've made $500,000 extra, that's way more than the $1,000 or $2,000 a year in fees to keep the thing going. So they're just going to have a bit bigger mindset. And understanding, it's about understanding as well.
With the, that's set up, like if you had three properties in that trust and then you sold one, would the banks want to get evaluation on the other two properties? Is that like?
That's a good question. Okay. So if you technically cross-collateralized, 100%. So if they were on the mortgage documents all securing each other, that's a massive downside of having a cross-collateralized property. We still see it. I've talked about not doing that for 20 years. But we still see, obviously my word's not everywhere, but we still see people who've got cross-collateralized properties, and that's a nightmare having that situation happen to you. So no. So if they're all in the one trust, no, you won't, even if you sell one, they won't revalue the other two. because in well, if we do it, they're not cross collateralized from a mortgage standpoint. Yeah. If they were, 100%, they will. And we see it, and it's horrible that if you sell a property and the bank does not like the coverage, because they will, if you've got three linked together, you sell one, they'll value the other two. And if they haven't got enough security margin in there, they won't give you all the sale proceeds of the first one. And we've seen people get caught out like that, and even withheld the whole amount, and they bought another property. Imagine how stressful that would be. It's diabolical. Yeah, you never want to cross collateralize.
Yeah, and by holding that amount, it's because the loan-to-value ratio is not to their appetite, so then they withhold to their risk perspective as well.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll agree for you to purchase a property that they don't like the security, but because you're giving them another security, they've agreed to do the loan. But if you sell the good security and you've only got a block of land they don't like left, their lending margin might be at 50% on that land, and so you've got to make sure that the LVR is a lot lower on what's left. They can get tricky.
So I guess that you know, having a couple of properties in one structure being cross collateralized has a lot of similarities in terms of people being fixated on interest rates, where people are very worried about the short term and not just having the foresight to think about the long term, you know, benefits or downfalls. Like with an interest rate, you know, maybe they can't, you know, if they're too fixated on it, something they're worried about paying too much money up front, but they're not foreseeing like how much a property could make them in the long term. And the same with like the cross collateralization, seeing that like I could buy more properties in the short term, but not noticing or realizing that what could happen if they wanted to sell one of those individually and not as a whole, or even as a whole, and then not reaping the full capital growth of that because they're cross collateralized.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. And look, I'm not downplaying people's thoughts about interest rates and fees. It's very important, and we do take it into account. And what we've seen over the last few years is, depending on the lenders they're using, some lenders have continued to creep their interest rates up in what they call their back book, so their existing loans. And some we've seen lots of clients at 8, 9, even 10% interest rate on loans they've had in place for the last few years, and they can't refinance, and those lenders won't give you interest rate reductions. If they do, they're very slim, because they know they can't go anywhere else. They've got a captive client. And so it's very difficult for those people. And look, there are some things that can be done that we talk to people about helping them there. But when we look at someone's portfolio, we're really solving for two problems that our clients have if they want to build a portfolio. One is, how do I get a deposit for my next purchase? So if they can't get a deposit, they're not buying anything. So one of our key focus, how do we maximize the equity in each of your properties, is the first thing. And the second thing we look at is borrowing capacity. How do we maximize your ability to borrow money so you can actually get their next property? So they're the two things we really solve for as a financier. We don't solve for who's got the best rate. Once we've solved those two questions, and maybe we have a couple of options, then we say, okay, let's get the best interest rate, the best fees of these lenders, which meet the criteria. So don't start with who's got the cheapest rate. Because if you start with, oh, Stephen, who's got the best rate? And I say, Banker Whoop Whoop over here, they got 2%. Everyone wants 2% for Banker Whoop Whoop. Problem is, no one's got borrowing capacity to get one of their loans. So that with them, you can only borrow 100 grand, but over here at NAB, you're at 500 grand. So where are you going to go? You're going to go to the one where you can actually buy a property. So no one's going to go to Banker Whoop Whoop, even though they've got the best interest rate deal ever, because their borrowing capacity is next to none. They only want someone who earns $1 million and has got $500 million in equity. That's all they want. And so we say, okay, don't focus on interest rate. Focus on that once you've met the criteria of who's got the best equity, who's got the best borrowing capacity, then of those lenders, let's get the best deal we can. That's how we sort of approach it.
Is there a risk in, if there's only one or two lenders willing to lend to you for this, for an next purchase, you know, you're kind of pushing the envelope to a certain extent, and are you then kind of like hamstrung in only utilizing that lender essentially? So like you're at the whim of them doing what they want with their own interest rates and their fees. Like, is there sort of a risk mitigation thing that you talk with clients saying, hey, this is the limit, or what's sort of that
experience? So they definitely know. If they're on the edge already, they know we would explain that we haven't got a lot of options, so this is where you're sitting. And I suppose it's the old horrible phrase, beggars can't be choosers. So it's whatever position you're in, you have to be realistic. And a lot of the times we have the realistic nature does not match with their attitude of world domination. So if someone's got the world domination attitude, I love that because I've got that attitude. But I've got, as a financier, I've got to be realistic about my ability to borrow money. And so we're trying to temper both of those. We're trying to keep people positive because they're pumped up. They want to grow the portfolio. They want to retire by 29. All these cool things, absolutely. But then on the other side of the equation, we've got the big bad banks. And the big bad banks won't just open their checkbook and do whatever you like. So we've got to understand the big bad bank's rule book, and then we've got to use that rule book to benefit you. So we might say, Sam, okay, at the moment, we can push you to the nth degree. We can trim over here. We can cut there. Well, something's happened there, Sam.
Sorry.
The bank's trimmed him.
Oh,
done, he went for world domination too early.
That's it. He's back. That's what we want.
Thanks for calling me, Sam. Right. Stop talking.
Yeah.
Damn, you've overexposed. What's going on? They pulled your pants down.
So
we're
continue on then, Steve.
Yeah. So look, yes. So I haven't met a property investor which is not trying to push the envelope. Most are because they're not where they want to be. They might be at two properties, they want to get at four. Okay. And interest rates over the last 30 years they've been doing this, so there's been really good times. So we had about 15 years where it's unbelievable. Interest rates were low. There was capital growth. Everyone had a job. It was fantastic. It's only been the last few years where things got diabolically hard for people. But thankfully, we're nearly at the end of that really hard bit. And I think we're going to go into start to get into the bit better phase again. We're going to see some good capital growth. We're going to see lower interest rates and people will be able to, you know, scoot along a bit quicker than what they have in the last couple of years. But yes, you're going to face a point in time, and a lot of people at that now, whereby you're right on the border. That you've got to do this over here, you've got to do that over there just to get that one extra, eke out that one property. And instead of buying that property in, I don't know, Mooney Ponds, you've had to buy it in, you know, Upper Ipswich or something like that. So maybe, you know, you can't get the prime inner metro, maybe you're somewhere else, but the numbers make sense. And that's what you can afford and that's what you're doing, because if that property still has the right metrics and there's some growth or there's a, you know, outstanding yield play or there's a subdivision potential or whatever it is, a reason for buying that property, at least you can move forward and get that compounding nature of the growth of that property instead of doing nothing. And so, yes, people do. It's understanding the risks. It is about having risk mitigants, and there are things you can put in place to minimize problems. And certainly I wouldn't say to someone, don't buy a property if you've got nothing left in the bank once you've settled. So if you settle and you've got $14.22 left, don't do it, because you're going to be stressed out of your head. Unless you love baked beans, and that's all you're going to eat for a year to build up your savings. But that will get, you know, tiring after probably a couple of weeks, unless you're, you know, some people. But be very careful. Don't leave nothing in the bank, because remember, you're building a business. You haven't bought a property. You're building a business. Businesses have expenses, and some things can come up that you don't plan for. Like, I haven't bought lots of properties. There's all sorts of things that can't go wrong. Maybe you need a new air conditioning unit, $2,500, which I've got to do right at the moment on a property. And things come up. So make sure you've got a certain amount. I'm sure you talk about this as well. A certain amount of money per property set aside to take care of those issues so you don't get stressed out.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to have a bit of like contingency money in place for each property. And just like in business as well, you know, some things, if you're in business outside of a property business, you know, sometimes there's unforeseen expenses that you need to pay. Also am a massive advocate for having some contingency funds or a bit of a war chest of, you know, 6 months expenses or sometimes even more, depending on the risk the business may or may not have. And you should be treating your property business the same way, I believe, anyway. Now, talking of world domination, you know, and everybody with the good attitude of trying to achieve an incredible result in a short time frame. When it comes to purchasing and acquiring property, and you've helped a lot of people build great portfolios, when do you see it make most financial sense for growth to speed up, to go from residential properties to commercial properties? This is something that I have been thinking about and toying with in my own portfolio. And I don't think there's enough good education out there on when to go from resi to commercial and when it makes financial sense. And I know it's very difficult because everybody's personal financial situation is different. But what's the typical or the general sort of way that somebody would move from resi to commercial in their portfolio?
I normally see it when people have a little bit more mature business or mature portfolio, because it's a very different thing, commercial, because the good thing, one of the best things about commercial is all the outgoings are paid by the tenant. So very, except for land tax generally. So that's a good thing. But one of the downsides of commercial, well, a couple of things. One of the downsides of commercial is that it can take longer to get a tenant. And so banks generally, when they're lending for commercial purposes, they like, because they know that, they like to generally have tenancies in place when they lend against it. And so if there's not a tenant in place when you're buying commercial, that means they may not have enough income in that structure to service it. So then you've got to use outside income to service that debt potentially. So it is a different financing perspective. Like, unlike residential, where you can get a letter from a real estate agent to say, oh, this is going to rent for $600 a week, the residential banks will take that rental into effect for residential. Commercial, they don't like doing that. So they can't say, oh, get a letter and say, this is going to rent for $100,000 a year. They don't like that. They like to see it in place. This is the lease in place. And some lenders even lend against the term of the lease. So if that lease has only got 6 months to go or a year to go, the bank, say if you went to a big bank, they might say, oh, we're only willing to give you a 2-year loan term. And then you've got to renegotiate the whole commercial loan after 2 years because the lease, well, some will even match up as Sam, I don't know if you're a commercial resi valuer, but in the commercial space, they could match up the lease term with the loan term. If you only got a year to go, that's not long. Whereas we do have some commercial lenders now that will give you up to a 30-year loan term, just like resi. And they'll give you an 80% LVR, 85% LVR, similar to resi with no mortgage insurance. So there's some pretty cool commercial products out there now, which are basically the same as a resi product, just in the commercial space. But obviously the big banks, they don't need to do that. They're not that competitive as yet, because still they get most of the business in the commercial space. So they're more the conservative end of the nature. Then you've got all these other new lenders playing the commercial area that do all sorts of things. And that's what I sort of say to people. It comes up a lot. Oh, I want to be with a big bank. And they say, oh, why? I say, oh, you know, they're the safest. I've banked with Commonwealth Bank since school. I have my money box, my passbook, and I love the Commonwealth Bank. I say, oh, that's great too. Well, you know, Commonwealth Bank are fantastic. But once they realize that the big four banks have about 80% or so of the market share of the entire mortgage industry, so there's only 20% less. So people don't realize there's about 424 lenders just in the resi space. So you've got four banks have about 80% market share. Then you've got 420 banks or lenders have 20% of the market share. Then I sort of say, okay, how do all these other lenders survive? How can they actually have a business when they're fighting for such a small piece of the pie? And really it's because they've got to be different. They've got to differentiate different policies, procedures, rates. So I say, okay, have an open mind. So I'm sort of training people, don't worry about the name of the bank. Just worry about what they're going to do for you. Are they going to approve your loan? Are they going to give you more equity? Are they going to let you go from one to three properties? These sort of questions. So forget who it is, because it doesn't matter. You've got their money. They don't have yours. It's different if you've got $500,000 in cash, then the bank's only guaranteeing $250,000 anyway. But at the end of the day, if you're borrowing off them, you know, you've got their money. They don't have yours. So they got to get it back off you somehow.
Yeah, I also like to think about the, you know, these other lenders that don't have as much market share, and you say, you know, how are they going to survive? Typically, they're going to need to do a better deal to survive, and it's going to be better for us in the long term, short term and long term. And they're typically going to bend over backwards a little bit more when it comes to say, hey, I want to lower my interest rate. You go and do that with CBA. They could be like, haha, good luck. Yeah,
well, that's not happening. At CBA, you're just a number.
Exactly. We've got the big brand. We've got the big name. We can do what we want, how we want, when we want. Yeah. But, you know, if you leave, they're not as worried. They're not as scared because they got so much business. But if you leave, say, a different lender, you know, they're not going to want that, right? So typically they're going to bend over backwards a little bit more than
Yes and no. Some of the small lenders have less room to move, and they have – some lenders take a stance that we're giving the same deal to everyone. So there's no special deals. So whether you're Bob or you're Kerry Packer or James Packer, you're getting the same rate. And that's just a stance, like an ethical stance, if you want to call it that. Then other lenders are different. So say Commonwealth Bank, like you mentioned. So they have all sorts of different deals for everyone that people don't realize. And because we're a premier broker with them, you know, we get very good deals and we get things approved that other brokers don't, because we give them a lot of business and we give them very good business. And unfortunately, that's not a level playing field, but it's just how it is. It's like the old survival of the fittest sort of stuff. And so all banks are different. So it's about understanding what they can do. We've lost Jared. We've been a bank run. He's gone.
I'm still here for you, mate.
Oh, good. and so, sorry, we've got a bit of a tangent off the commercial stuff, but
I do have a question with that commercial.
Yes.
It's a big shift in the economy for or the banking lending environment, not the economy, sorry, about the commercial lending rates of 30 years.
Yep.
Is there not a risk in them flipping on that? Like, say you go down, you buy this commercial property, you've got that solidarity of borrowing for 30 years. You know, if it is a variable rate, do they not have the right to say, like, in 5-10 years, oh, look, this product is now no longer being put forward? Like,
yeah, look, anyone has that right. It's happened in the resi space too, especially when we went back a few years ago to the GFC, that some lenders went belly up and pulled products. So the classic at the moment is, I used to love this product called a line of credit. Now almost no bank holds it. Most banks have now got rid of their line of credit product and they've migrated people onto other products. So yes, the banks have, they're running a business. So they can change basically anything they like and their contracts basically say they can. And they make $10 billion a year, so they'll do whatever they want. We don't have a say in it. So what I find, Sam, is that things change all the time. And so especially with what we do and what my philosophy is that don't sit on your laurels, get a loan and set and forget it and never look at it, the loan. So we like to look at things every year because our clients are investors. All they're thinking of doing is two things. How do I maximize the equity in my property to get a deposit? And how do I increase my borrowing capacity? So today we might go with one lender who's got a 30-year loan term and it's going along well and everything's happy. But let's say we go and get a valuation because they want to get out equity to buy another property. And let's say their valuation's at 1 million. And you believe that's a ripoff. That valuer's on drugs. He's got that wrong. Then we go and get another valuer and that valuer says 1.5. Oh, I want that one. But that valuer is with a different bank. So all of a sudden we've been with one bank for a year and a half or 2 years. But now we've got to go over here because this other lender is going to give us 500,000 more valuation. So at the end of the day, we don't care who the lender is. We just want them to show us the money. And so the other lender might give us more equity and maybe they've given us a better borrowing capacity at this point in time. So we're going to move. So we're not really being, I don't say loyal, there's no loyalty. I just say, what is in it for you? As the investor, you've got to look after your business. And say, as a business, you've got shareholders and you are responsible to your shareholders to make the right financial decisions. So if your decision is, I've got to go to over here to a different financier, because they're going to give us more money to grow the profits of the business. Well, you've got an obligation to your shareholders. Your shareholders probably happen to be you and your wife. So that's fine. Remember, it's a legal entity and you're the shareholder of that company. So you've got to make the right decisions for that company. And the wrong decision would be to stay with, say, Commonwealth Bank or whoever it is for 30 years, pay them all their profits, don't get what you need, and you're not really ahead financially where you could have been by playing the market and moving it when you have to make the better decisions. And so, yes, the chances of you being with the one lender for 30 years is probably remote because that one lender is probably not going to have the best valuations, the best borrowing capacity, the best deal for 30 years. They're going to chop and change. So that would be my, I can't remember a client who's been with the one lender the whole time. Maybe there are people out there, old school people who are 80 or 70, they might have, but certainly the under 50 brigades, under 60 brigades probably haven't been with the same lender the whole time, most of the time. But back on that, commercial. One of the things with commercial also is that because one of our goals is to release equity to grow in the commercial space, in most cases, you're paying for a full valuation as well. If you were sort of asking the difference between resi and commercial, it's much more expensive to transact in the commercial area because valuations could run into the thousands of dollars per property, whereas most residential ones are free. Some aren't. Some you've got to pay $200-$400, but that's a lot cheaper. So it's just a cost consideration in commercial. So leverage is generally, on average, generally less in commercial. Costs are generally more. Some commercial lenders, you've got to be very careful about why you're pulling out money. So if you're pulling out $500,000 out of a commercial property, some lenders, if you say, I'm doing that to buy residential investment properties, they might not agree. They might not like that reason. So you've got to also take that into account as well when you're doing it, because you've got to meet the bank's criteria when whatever you're doing with that bank.
No.
There's pros and cons, but you know, if you're going to get a little, office or retail or warehouse, they're great little assets to have, and generally a pretty good cash flow. And you might want to pair that up with something else to keep that business positively geared. That seems reasonable.
Yeah, there's two sort of underlying things that are shining in my face is after this conversation. It's really like when it comes to building our portfolios, finding properties that, you know, give you that cash flow is really important to keep growing, essentially. And that's, I mean, from buying properties around Australia as well, like, there's always trade-offs. And that's where the second point is, you're investing. There is risk in investing. I try to focus on what's the way we can reduce as much risk as possible to give you that sleep at night factor. And there's been some really good sort of tips, especially just that cash buffer as well. And,
to have it.
To find a broker too, like yourself, that every year is so important just to assess your portfolio. Like there's no passive, like there's passive income, right? But there's always a level of work that's required as like you're building a business out here. So it's kind of just, keeping those two things in mind. But for yourself, would you say that's like the top two sort of thoughts that through this conversation, Jared, or what else do you think you're getting out of this one?
Yeah, I've gotten so much, Stephen. Like it's really about having the right structure, focusing on the right things, you know, cash flow, good property and interest rate, not interest rates, you know, obviously how much borrowing capacity you can get, and getting the right property and, the structuring was massive for me. So thanks so much, Stephen, for coming on. We've gone a little bit over time, but you've just fire hosed us with so much and we're just so grateful. So thank you.
No problem at all.
If you've got more, mate, in that brain, I definitely want to have another conversation, but what else did you have? You had something to say?
I was just going to say a couple of things about borrowing capacity, because a lot of people get hampered by the borrowing capacity. And when lenders look at that, they're looking at income and expenses. On the expense side, people just don't realize last 10 years have been pretty good for people on the whole, except for the last one or two. And so people's expenditures changed. So people tend to spend a lot more than what they really need. And it's about, if you really want to grow a big portfolio, you've really got to analyze what you're spending to work out whether this is going to help you in the next few years. So if you really want to build a portfolio, you need to cut some things you don't really need, the discretionary stuff, initially. Once you've built your portfolio that you want, go and spend as much as you like. But, you know, you don't need to have five or six different, you know, TV sort of deals going on. You don't need to eat Uber Eats 10 times a week. You know, I don't know if you guys go out to restaurants. Crikey, they cost a lot now.
I don't do that. But there's a saying that Jared and I had this probably in the earlier podcast, is that people are running around, they're spending money that they don't have to buy things they don't need to impress people that they probably don't like or may not like in the future. So it's kind of just that the biggest thing comes down to, like, for the start point in my mind is just budgeting. It's pretty simple.
People hate it though. So I've known over the years that I have that, because from the financial planning background, budgeting's critical. But not 98% of people hate doing budgets. But I say do it once. Just do it once. Have an idea of where you're sitting and then plan from that. Because people aren't going to, they might do it for a week and then fall off the cliff because they don't want to continue it. Some people love spreadsheets, and there's so many budgeting tools out there, and it's so easy to do if you really want to do it. But things like, you know, obviously big decisions, private school, maybe this is a different podcast, how private school fees and school fees affect borrowing capacity, how rent vesting or, say, owning your own home versus just buying rental properties has a massive impact on your ability to build a portfolio.
I'd love to hit on that for sure, because I think there's a massive misconception in society around that.
And I've run the numbers, and when you really look at it, it's a huge impact on your ability to borrow and grow. And it's unfortunate now that, you know, home loans, when you get to retirement age, it's still 65 at the moment. 33% of people in Australia still have a home loan. 33% when they retire, which is, America's a little bit higher than that, and it's getting worse. So we're changing the way we live, the way people's perception of owning property, it's all changing. And you really have to understand the numbers, because I still see a lot of people trying to buy their dream home as their first property. And if they do that, they're so far behind the eight ball, and it leads to, I don't know the stats, but it can lead to financial stress, which leads to divorce, because you're so committed out the gate. And if you've got the dream home in the dream area, well, then you've got to have the dream cars, and little Johnny and Mary got to go to the dream school. And all of a sudden, you know, they got to go on the dream holiday instead of going camping down at Apollo Bay. They're over to Europe skiing in the Alps, and all of a sudden, four years later, they're broke and divorced.
there's a I swear there's a design from, you know, I mean, this is sort of getting a bit woo-woo, but that they keep you in the hamster wheel, you know, like we're sort of, I was that person, like my parents, my mum's a school teacher, our dad was a jack of all trades, but tradesman turned real estate, turned you know, the small business owner. And I was always go to school, get good grades, get a good job, PAYG, and then buy your home, you know, pay it down in 30 years and then look to invest. And it never made any logical sense. And yeah, obviously I was changing that in my family. But then you start to learn, it's like your first home is not your forever home. It never, like, chances are it won't be. So it's like, well, what are you actually stressing yourself out for this thing you're going to have to sell down, agent's fees, stamp duty, all these costs involved.
Yeah.
And then there's also the opportunity cost of, you know, capital growth, which chances are where you're wanting to live, it may not be the best place for capital growth in Australia. So, yeah. I'm keen to break this down a bit more in the future, Stephen, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favourite topics, because that's probably the biggest reason why people don't achieve financial success is that they start with their own home. That's probably the number one reason they have a problem.
It's wild how they kind of go, oh, I want to buy this property, which is an asset. But when you buy a big home, you're basically buying a liability, and people don't see how, like, it can be a red line decision versus a green line decision in terms of the compounding effects, the negative compounding effects. To what, if you were to use that opportunity cost of those dollars that went into that deposit to invest in a different way versus being, I have this big fancy home now and I feel good about my life, or my ego at least. I think it's important for us to definitely feel good about ourselves mentally, but you can do that without having to have everything all at once and on the inside losing, you know, freaking out and losing your hair, you know.
But you can't, Jared, you can have everything all at once. You can rent an unbelievable suburb and pay a lot less and live actually better. Yeah. But also, it's not just the mortgage, the deposit of buying that property. People don't realize that when you own your own home, you then buy better furniture. You then have to keep the upkeep of the property. You've got to paint the property. You've got to do all the maintenance on the property. The costs are exponentially higher by owning your own home versus renting. We won't, there's a lot of information, so I won't go into it now because you'll be here for hours, but it's a very passionate topic of mine because it really holds people back from achieving what they really thought they could achieve.
Well, the worlds have aligned, Stephen, for us to delve into this a bit deeper. But I was conscious of everyone's time as well.
Yeah.
So thank you.
All good. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for coming on, Steve. Really appreciate it. We'll be putting links to you know, Loans Australia in the show notes. So check them out, guys. They've done an awesome job for me, and I'm sure they'll be able to help you guys as well. So thanks again, Steve.
Thanks, everyone. All the best. Appreciate it.
Thanks, mate. Really appreciate it.
No problem.